Welcome back to The Breakdown, an everyday analysis breaking down the most important stories in Bitcoin, crypto, and beyond with your host, NLW. The Breakdown is distributed by CoinDesk.
Welcome back to The Breakdown. It is Friday, March 20th, and today I am joined by Peter McCormick. Now, my guess is that most of you know Peter McCormick from his podcast, What Bitcoin Did, which is one of the best and one of the most popular Bitcoin podcasts in the space. Peter also has a new podcast slash video production called Defiance. And Defiance is about a world in upheaval, right? And going out and finding the stories of people who are trying to exert more agency and sovereignty and liberty over their lives, right? And it seems clear for those of us who have been in Bitcoin for a while how these different ideas connect together. But Peter really wanted a space to actually tell a different type of story. And so Peter recently got back from a bunch of different travel, both around Bitcoin and the Defiance podcast, that took him to the border of Turkey and Greece, as well as all over South America. So my original plan was to ask him about that travel and what he learned and how it related to Bitcoin and just kind of have a catch-up conversation on that. What it turned into, and this is both introduction and warning, I guess, is much more of an extended conversation between friends around what it's like right now trying to make sense of politics in the age of the coronavirus. So I think if there's one main thread that goes through our conversation, it's the idea of nuance and specificity and being willing to not let yourself or being unwilling to let yourself be boxed into any one ideological label when everything incentivizes you to do that. And questioning whether on the other side of this coronavirus, whenever that happens, if the new world that gets remade, because I do believe that we are at that pivotal a moment of inflection and change, can be structured in a way that doesn't just prioritize and incentivize rank internecine warfare between ideological ideas, rather than thoughtful exchange and debate. Now, like I said, this is both introduction and warning. There are plenty of you who have been listening for interviews around macroeconomic policy who will have no interest in this conversation, because like I said, it's much more conversational. It's about politics. It's about global affairs. And so if this is not your cup of tea, I totally understand. I'll be back on Monday with another awesome breakdown show. But if you are looking for just a chance to decompress a little and think about the broad context of all these issues we're living through, maybe this will be something that you enjoy. Now, one last warning, this is, like all our interviews, far less edited than our normal programming, and this one is definitely live, uncensored, and uncut. We get a little passionate with our words at certain points, but I hope you enjoy it. I appreciate you listening. Stay safe out there, and I will be back with another episode of The Breakdown on Monday. Peace, guys. All right, so I am here with the infamous Peter McCormick. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Nathaniel? Very strange times right now.
It is strange times. Like, I feel like our younger selves talked about strange times last year, probably, and you know, whatever. Like, it's officially crazy times, and it seems like it's been especially crazy for you lately.
Well, yeah, I think it's strange for everyone now, and I think the situation that we all feared. I don't know, actually. I kind of get the feeling some people, I'm going to try and pick my words carefully, but some people are watching this situation and seeing things they expected to play out in terms of governments and the centralized control play out exactly as they've always said it would. And I'm very fearful right now of getting into the whole extended reach of the state, that this is going to be used by the government to exert bigger control over us. They're going to put the army on the streets and reduce our civil liberties and take control of our money, blah, blah, blah. All those things that people in our field have been talking about for quite a long time, that's been happening anyway, that seems to be accelerating right now. My view is that I understand why some of this is accelerating now in terms of the armies on the streets. And I'd like to unwrap that with you, actually, and go into that. And I think it's a natural reaction by the governments. And I just think we need to be very careful to hold them to an account, that when we come out at the end of this, this doesn't change the way we are treated as humans, and it doesn't change our relationship between us and the government.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you and I were starting to chat about this the other day, but this is this is not good for Twitter engagement, but this is a time that really, really calls for nuance in the way that we, because there's so many things that are not mutually exclusive. You can believe that it is a time for extraordinary measures while also wanting very ardently to ensure that the those extraordinary measures in those extraordinary times aren't just kind of casually filtered to normal, right? And the problem is that a lot of the dialogue around those things is going to be totally binary, either a fear panic based reaction of you know, we'll give away all our liberty for the sake of security, or on the other hand, a dismissive, almost, you know, like the government shouldn't be helping at all because it's going to just lead to this. It's all the slippery slope, right? The slippery slope argument. Mm-hmm. And there is a big, big middle space that is about specifics. And I think that that's what I keep coming back to. It's like, let's not, for me, what I'm watching personally is specific instances of, you know, even to the granularity of like, what is the nature of the conversation that the US government is having right now with Facebook, Google? What's the type of data? What are they looking in? Aggregate data? Is there person, like, you know, these things, these nuances are important. Even if you're coming from a position of, a very strong kind of personal privacy and personal liberty. And unfortunately, I think that it's hard to have nuanced, calm discussions in a time where honestly, the volume is, you know, this time goes to 11, but it's actually like 13, you know, or 14 right now.
I think nuance is important here. Like you said, I saw something on Twitter the other day where somebody, or even today, somebody said, and I think it might've been in San Francisco, certainly California, that somebody was fined $400 for walking their dog or being with a friend or something. And again, I don't know if that's true. It sounds believable. And if it hasn't happened, sounds like the type of thing that is going to happen. But I think it's a bit unnecessary. I think it's one of those situations where the person, the police officers could have said, look, we need people off the streets and this is why. But I, where I get really stuck at the moment is I've been led down the road, a new road in my life with libertarians and anarcho-capitalists who talk about personal freedom and nobody should tell anyone what to do, etc., etc. And I fully understand that. And there's a lot I agree with. I talked to Giacomo Zucco about this the other day. I agree with a lot of it. But also at the same time, we don't have anywhere an anarcho-capitalist society. We don't have anywhere have a libertarian government. So we are in a world where we have the state, and the state is going to respond to a situation like this. And watching the footage in Italy, which is quite frankly terrifying. I've watched the footage in the hospital today. We've also just had a news announcement from in London where, listen to this. This is a critical incident at London Hospital after surge in coronavirus cases. Basically, they've hit capacity. Their ICU has hit capacity. So if the ICU is at capacity, they're going to have to be at that point where they choose who to treat. If you don't have enough ventilators, you're going to have to give somebody another option. Perhaps that's some kind of hand ventilator, or perhaps you don't have a machine, or perhaps you have to turn around to a 92-year-old and give their machine to a 46-year-old because they've got more chance of survival. And that's the decisions they're going to have to be making. And I've got a friend who works at an ICU in Australia, and he said, we're very early now, but we are preparing for wartime triage where we are going to have to be choosing about who to give machines to and who we help survive and who we may have to let go. And he said, he's terrified. So we are at the situation where we've seen something expand rapidly globally. In the space of a few months, it's gone from patient zero in China to thousands of people, like over 1,000 people dying now per 24 hours. I think we've hit that point. Infection rates are obscene. So if the government is going to respond, whilst we don't want infringements on our civil liberties and we want everyone to have personal freedom, personal choice, I can still understand why the government is thinking, well, we perhaps need to put the army on the streets and say to people, stay home. And this is why, because you're going to get sick and you might make other people sick. And I guess a tough nuance in that is, Well, somebody who's a libertarian might say, well, I observe the non-aggression principle. I'm not going to go near anybody else, and I'm not going to spread this because I don't want to make anyone sick, and I'm just going to keep myself to myself. But what happens if they get on a bus or go somewhere and they leave, you know, they are infected, and they leave, you know, the virus on the surface for 3 days and affect somebody else? So I very much want to support civil liberties and freedom and not have an extension of the state. But right now, I really understand why some of the governments are doing what they're doing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think too, again, since I've already screwed myself by saying that the theme of the conversation is going to be nuance, let's keep going with this theme, right? Like there's a very strong argument, if you are kind of a small government oriented person, that one of the functions of the state should be to be able to exert power in this sort of situation, right? To be able to have effective state power deployed. In fact, Tyler Cowen, who is probably the most widely read, popular libertarians, right? Marginal Revolution. He's not on the fringes of intellectual society. He's right in the mainstream, right? He's interviewed everyone. He wrote about this. He has a term for it that I'll pull up at some point when you're talking, because it's worth looking. But this is part of his argument, is that it's not it's not mutually exclusive to be a small L libertarian, but also think that this sort of the state being able to deploy the right type of power in these situations is correct. Now, the interesting thing is what does it look like to be correct? One thing that's been really fascinating for me to watch over the last week. So I'm in New York, right? I'm in the Hudson Valley. So I'm outside of New York City. There's been a huge kind of disagreement between Cuomo and de Blasio. De Blasio keeps talking about shelter in place. He wants shelter in place. And Cuomo has been aggressive about that. In every press conference, he said words matter. And basically New York, for those who haven't been paying attention, has decreased. On Wednesday, they said that only 50% of the workforce of non-essential businesses could go into work, right? So, this is after restaurants had gone takeout only and certain types of businesses had been closed down where there's a lot of, interaction and things like that. But even aciding all that, any other business, Wednesday it was 50%, Thursday it was 75%, today it went to 100%. And he said, this is the most severe thing. And he was like, basically the point that he was making is that shelter in place is a specific term that now refers to an active shooter. It came from from the nuclear era, when it meant literally go to the center of your house and stay there until you hear clear. What his point was that when we say shelter in place, it scares people. Like, we're not in the business of imprisoning people in their homes. What we're saying is that what we can do, and there's plenty of people who argue that this is still too extreme from a business perspective, but he's like, what we can do is say businesses can't operate right now. And what we can do is we can say, please don't leave your home for anything other than essential. But like a walk is essential for some people's mental health. Walking your dog, you're not going to be fine for that, right? And so it's an interesting little tightrope where he's trying to get as much voluntary contribution from people so that there doesn't have to be draconian measures, you know? But at the same time, he kind of went off on young people who aren't taking this seriously. Like, so there's this tightrope act, but there is a possibility of getting that tightrope act right. I think one thing that I haven't seen from the conversation that's been frustrating me is, so let's play this out. We're talking about, well, what are the real economic impacts of this? And we're talking about how does the state retreat from that authority right later? And it seems very clear to me that the reason that this thing is so deadly is the overwhelming of the healthcare system, right? It is about the way that the healthcare system gets overwhelmed. I just heard of a friend right before this call who lost her 99-year-old mother or grandmother not because of coronavirus, but because the hospital wouldn't let her in. They didn't have any space for her. So like that is, it's a hospital capacity question. We need a friggin' like a very fast Marshall Plan right now for getting all of the medical supplies, for getting the field hospitals, for deploying that full might, so that, because we will have to resume life, but we need this new infrastructure. And guess what? Like, we could be potentially putting people to work building that infrastructure. Like that is the key thing. And that's the point at which, well, how do we get to transition back to a different life? We have the infrastructure to be able to deal with this as what it is, which is a very virulent but addressable virus.
Mm. it's a very, very complicated situation. I mean, actually, not the other thing. Are we the same age? I can't remember if I'm a bit older. I'm 41.
I'm 35. So
you're 35. So you're a bit younger, but like similar-ish. It's such a strange situation. It's almost overwhelming in that about two and a half weeks ago, I called my father because he's 72 and he's a smoker and has bronchitis. So he is prime candidate for contracting, if he contracts coronavirus, that he would almost certainly need a ventilator and possibly die. You know, he's a prime candidate because it's a respiratory virus. So I phoned him two and a half weeks ago. Actually, I phoned my brother first. I said, I think we need to put Dad into lockdown. And my brother wasn't sure. And then about 2 days later, he agreed. And I said, Dad, now's the time. And he said, I can't. I've got all my golf stuff on. I was like, hold on, Dad. You need to really understand this. And I took him through it. And then I also phoned my ex-wife's parents and did the same. And I think I realized how serious this was, probably a little bit ahead of my friends because of the world we live and work in.
Yeah, yeah.
We're attached to the news a bit more. We follow a bit more. But it's this kind of weird kind of spectrum of wanting to take it seriously as possible without looking ridiculous to other people who think you're panicking. And I think everybody's eventually going to get on the spectrum to the extreme end where they realize how serious this is. It's just going to take them a lot of time. But as we get there, we've got to make some serious decisions. And I don't know if I don't want to be the person who stands there and says, well, I think the state should take control of this and put the army on the streets and tell us what to do, because we live in this Bitcoin world. Whereas if you ever show any form of statism, it's used as an insult against you. Oh, you bloody statist. You're a statist. You're a bootlicker. You're a government loving statist. Any kind of insult. So you're almost questioning yourself saying, well, I am. I'm thinking, fuck, I think there's a lot the state can do right now. I think there's certain things the state can do better than individuals can do on their own, right? Because I believe they just put some enforcement in place, and it's gross and it's scary and it's terrifying. And you made a really good use of language when you said how does the state retract from this position, which is very, mm-hmm. I think you've articulated that perfectly. But right now, if we were to just give advice to people and tell them what to do, we saw what happened in Nashville or on the beaches in Florida, people were ignoring it. And I just feel like I almost don't want to have the state argument now, the libertarian argument now. I want to say, what is the best thing we can do? And I'm not going to get over upset by certain actions of the state, because just because so many fucking people are going to die. And I think, and then I try and measure it, and I try and question it to myself, and I think, all right, well, if freedom is the most important thing to me, civil liberties, then we should give everyone the advice, but let everyone have free will to choose what they will do. But does that ultimately lead to many more people dying? Giacomo Zucco will come and give a very good, nuanced argument about why I'm wrong. My gut feel thinks that this is a situation where we have no choice but the state to put in some draconian measures. But I say it with this kind of Bitcoiner guilt, thinking, oh, I'm not meant to stand for this. I'm meant to be against this. I'm meant to say, no, this isn't right. And almost certainly a lot of the stuff they're going to do is wrong. I think the UK government's initial decision seemed brave. And within 2 days, I was like, no, you got this wrong. You fucked that up. I think almost certainly Trump has got an awful lot wrong. And I really don't like his rebranding of the virus as the Chinese virus. I think he's running every press conference like a PR exercise in the 2020 election. I don't like that. And that doesn't mean I support China or I'm a CCC bootlicker. I just don't like that. So I think the governments are going to make a lot of fucking mistakes because they're dealing with something unprecedented and it's really, really hard. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm in this place that I can give some... I don't know. I don't think now is the time to be arguing over civil liberties in terms of some of the decisions the state's making now. I think now's the time to say, how do we ensure when this is over that they do retract from these positions, that we don't lose a bunch of freedoms, well, the limited freedoms we already have, we don't lose them. And I think that's a more practical place to approach it from.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think my feeling is almost always, and certainly in this case, is that everyone gets to have a different voice and a different importance. One of the things that I've always loved about Bitcoiners much more extreme than I am, whether it's about the crypto industry or whether it's about libertarian politics or anything like that, is that they provide an unflappably clear pull of the discourse, right? That is an anchor point that you can go to. And I think that a free, open society only works if you can have perspectives at both extremes screaming at each other. Now, where I usually find myself is wanting, I tend by nature to be radically more pragmatic than I would like to be even. Like, I have this very strong and weird combination of incredibly kind of frustrated and passionate, but then like want to hone in on the thing that can be addressed. So right now, for example, I'm looking at this bill that was happening before coronavirus that is trying to get end-to-end encryption out of the way, right? And this has been, Attorney General Barr has been fighting this fight since a while ago, right? It's been him versus Apple. And Apple has been fighting, but they've kowtowed in certain ways at certain points. But that is a specific discrete thing, right? That doesn't really necessarily have to do. I think smart people can argue about how much tracking and surveillance is really necessary for this, you know? And although in some ways I'm much more worried about the tracking and surveilling of every citizen via their mobile app than I am about local police forces enforcing a curfew, even if I think, like, you know, curfews seem like a weird, you know, choice to me, right? Like, in some ways, those are different things. So I'm going to be flying the flag of and hearing about that other thing, that specific thing. But, you know, I also think that right now there is a little bit of a pick your battles situation, in the sense of there are some things that have left the station. Like, no one, like, we have gone from there is no longer any political space for not direct intervention in people's bank accounts in this. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think that the biggest reason is that there's also no political will in Congress or the Senate to not bail out companies, but they also, having lived through 2008, know that they can't not bail out regular people and bail out companies as well. They can't bail out companies and not bail out regular people as well. There's no way that anyone will get voted, but perhaps they can, you know, they're very scared to let industries, to let companies die, right? Like, this is a system that feels fragile to everyone that they're going to try to preserve with whatever they can. So like us screaming about UBI and things like this or whatever, you know, or, you know, quantitative easing and the money printer, like, these are the new narratives, the new memes. But the reality is that this is a situation where we already had an answer to that, which is Bitcoin and participation in the Bitcoin ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, this crisis is the first one that's happened where there is a voluntary opt-out mechanism, at least on some level. Now, we all live in society, so I think it's overstated to say that we're opting out entirely, but there is this other thing, right? So I feel like a lot of this has to do with one, picking your battles, two, figuring out where there's actually levers of change to pull. And the reality is that when people are dying, when hospitals are being overwhelmed, and when people are losing their jobs, you're not going to win most arguments about not intervening. So I go right to the other side of that conversation and say, there will be a time at which this has gotten more under control, right? Where the healthcare mm-hmm. system has gotten more under control. What can we not give up on the way?
Yeah. Do you know, can I talk about something as well that I still haven't seen the answer for? Because, mm-hmm. so we're at this point now where we're having to put, every almost country is going through the same steps, just at a different time. And I'm seeing the US is doing it. If you think each state is more like a country, they're going through a similar process whereby it's, okay, we've got some infections. Okay, the infections are going up. We've had a death. Oh, now we've had double figures deaths. Now the uptick's starting to happen. So the UK is in the real uptick right now. Italy is way ahead of everybody. France and Spain, Germany aren't looking great. You know, US is starting to pick up. And during that process, they go through you have concerns from the politicians that initially they start talking about perhaps we won't have enough ventilators or enough machines. And then they start talking about, okay, we're probably going to have to consider social distancing, and people are starting to make some of their own choices, a little bit of panic buying, you know, maybe telling their parents to lock themselves down. And then the government comes in and says, okay, we need to enforce some social distancing. We're going to close down the schools. Okay, now you can't go to work. Everyone should work from home. And now it's full lockdown. Every country appears to be following a very similar trajectory with all of this. And the reason they're following that trajectory is because of the infection rates are so rapid that, as you said earlier, the health systems are coming under so much pressure. What I don't understand is, and what nobody has explained is, how do we come out of this? Because even if in, say the UK can flatten the curve. We've had this flatten the curve. Say they can do it in 12 weeks or even 16. We've got 3 to 4 months of lockdown. Suppose they flatten the curve. Then what? What do you do there? If we're talking about not having a vaccine for, say, 18 months, even a year, let's say even a year, what happens between month 3 and 4 and month 12? Are a handful of people allowed to go to work? Is specific towns allowed to go to work? Do we have to have in some place some way of tracking it, who has an infection and who they're coming into touch with? And if a new infection happens, then anyone who's coming to touch that person has to be locked down again. And if you do that, we're going to have schizophrenic businesses that pop up and shut down very quickly. So that's not going to be operational. We're never going to get children back to school. So it feels like, realistically, we're in this until there's a vaccine. I can't see how we come out of it. And I'll be honest, this is the first time in my life I've actually been really scared. Not personally, just more scared generally for people and what's going to happen over the next 12 months. Because you've got entire industries the airline industry is done right now, pretty much. The crew, nobody's going to go on a cruise right now. Hotels are screwed. And then all the knock-on businesses from there. What about the restaurants in the hotels? What about the companies that supply the parts to the airlines? What about the engineers who work for the airlines? What about the airports themselves? What about the taxi drivers that take people from the airport home? The knock-on effect from this, I think, is frightening. I don't know the answer, but I just don't see. Are we in this? Are we all locked down now for a year?
Well, I do think so. A couple thoughts. First is that there is going to be some precedent, right? We can watch how Asia is trying to manage this and see what works. And the thing that's clear is that they've redesigned. I mean, they were already way ahead of us on this, but the you don't go into a building right now in Singapore without having your temperature checked, right? It is just a totally different experience of life where everything is about controlling potential outbreaks, right? And being able to get that cluster. I think there's still really good questions about school and how that's working and everything else. But I think that it's going to be an extreme amount of vigilant data gathering and information. So that's kind of like part one. I mean, but at least if nothing else, there will be some, we have a couple months to we're behind by enough time to see what's working, right? I mean, for better or worse, they get to be the guinea pigs, you know, in this. I think the second part is, you know, we've largely, because it's really, I mean, let's be clear about what our timeline is. It has really only been a few weeks since the US started to take this seriously. February 24th was literally the first day that markets reacted to this at all in the US. I know because it was the day that Caitlin Long announced Avanti and I interviewed her and we were talking about how the markets had just started to react for the first time. February 12th, meanwhile, was all-time highs, right? So 12 days between that and less trading days, obviously. And now we are only we're at the end right now of the first full week where the US president acknowledged the severity of this thing and wasn't just calling it another flu, right? If you go back not to 2 Mondays ago, right? So 4 days ago and then 7 days before that, he put out a tweet about how the flu kills so many more people, right? It wasn't until Wednesday of that week that Tom Hanks got it, the NBA shut down, and Trump got on TV and said, we actually have to do something about this. Mm-hmm. So we're really still like in the US, we're like, 7 working days, you know, 9 days total into the leadership of the country not being totally insane about this thing. And we've done, it's almost like, I'm watching this weird thing. Like this is to me, this is a health issue that creates a financial markets issue, that creates an economic issue, that potentially creates a geopolitical issue. And it's almost like we're watching these things like, so, you know, we're finally taking the health issue seriously. However, we're dealing right now with the still testing dimension of it, right? Not the overwhelm the healthcare system yet, which is what's right around the corner, which is why people are so scared, and they should be from an infrastructure perspective. With the financial markets, obviously we've seen a huge sell-off, but the Fed is using every tool that it has. The federal government is obviously using every tool that it has to try to keep this in check. What we haven't experienced yet is the economic knock-on, really, right? Because again, people haven't been out of work for long. If you go back to Cuomo, he went from 50% of the workforce to 75% of the workforce to 100% over 3 days. He knew the math. He knew exactly how much this was going to go. He used that time, I believe, to get people more and more used to the idea, right? Rather than going 0 to 100 and scaring the shit out of people. That was a specific psychological tactic, you know, which honestly I applaud him for. I think in some ways this is the correct call, although maybe a week earlier or whatever, right? So you've got just the beginnings of the economic hardship that this is going to represent. And we have never had anything this fast, you know? And like the only hope is that it's, someone called it World War III for 90 days. And that would be the best case scenario, where by July 15th, when US taxes are due and, you know, that we actually have gotten the healthcare system under control, people can start to go back to work. And the big money printing machine, you know, has helped people get through that part or whatever it is, right? People have done it together. I'm more worried because I see, like you, I think that it's everything, that it's so much more than just the 20% of people are in the service industry, right? So you've already got that, but there's a million more things that aren't accounted for that. And I think that you come across this, like you just think for a little bit, right? Like, you know, we've joked about this before, but our family's favorite hobby is Magic the Gathering. There are thousands and thousands of local game stores all around the country who are for tons of different games, but they're anchored around that, who are just cooked. They're already hanging on by a thread because they're from a different time, right? Where we went to stores and, you know, played games together rather than doing it online, which is so much more convenient. Like the number of that companies in that space, small businesses that are going to shut down, is going to be enormous. And like, I don't know, card stores, like your local Bath and Body Shop, that's just someone who had a dream, like florists, like, you name it, you know what I mean? Like I think we haven't even begun to grapple with what that might mean. Now, the thing that I think that we're extra not grappling with, though, is the what might happen geopolitically globally, right? Like we are already at the tail end of the US designed post-World War II order, where we are retreating. We are aggressively retreating from the world. You know, I mean, this has been Trump, he's continuing things. He's accelerated it certainly, but this has been going on for a while, is a retreat from the world. And
one of the few things I actually like, I was going to say, that's one of the few things I actually like about what Trump's been doing. He seems to want to get away from wars and intervention, which is one of the few things I actually admire about him.
Well, I agree. I'm no fan of war, but I do think too that there are untold consequences, right? In terms of like when you start to unwind an order where everything is interconnected from a global shipping, what you do is you create a scenario where all of a sudden there are really rich countries and really poor countries, not based on where they sit in the global order, but based on their actual resources. And it does not look, I mean, this is, I'm literally just a parrot for Peter Zeihan right now, who just wrote Disunited Nations. But this is my background too. This is where when I first, you know, I was in global change systems and things like that. I thought I was going to spend my life working in Israel, Palestine, or Uganda and Rwanda. And I think that we haven't grappled that, except maybe a little in the, like even the Chinese virus thing, which I feel very similar to you about. The cynical brilliance of this guy when it comes to manipulating the news cycle is unfathomable. And this is, I thought for sure, the incalculably bad response that he has had to coronavirus was going to be his undoing. But I think the ability to shift it to a us versus them at a time when everyone's angry, it plays right into the rights narrative that liberals are just, you know, social justice warriors who are concerned about racism. Like this is a thing that is basically definitionally racist, But that's not the point. He's not doing it as a dog whistle racism thing. That's just a fun byproduct, right? The reason that he's doing this is two things. One is that the CCP is in a fight for their life because the Chinese citizens have never been as closer to rebelling as they are now after this situation. And so they are desperately trying to put that narrative of the U.S. actually starting it, right? So there's a geopolitical brinksmanship being played there, signals to the rest of the world. That's one thing that's going on. Now, I think that there's a lot of very smart, savvy geopolitical thinkers who think that responding to that in kind is a really stupid strategy. So I'm not commenting on the quality of the strategy. I'm just saying that's part of it. The second part of it is this fucker has to, excuse me, listeners, but he has to shift the narrative from literally, like I said, 2 Mondays ago, he was saying it was as bad as the flu to I've always taken this seriously. And in fact, if you go back, the one thing he did do is close the borders to China real fast because that was fine with him, right? That was played into what he did. He wants everyone to say like, it was a Chinese virus. I closed the borders to China. We did everything, you know, like that. And it plays perfectly to his political base. It's an easier narrative. You know, it's an easier narrative than me in October going back and showing, well, like this was the death toll at this time. And this is what they said. And this was the death toll. Like no one's going to care. They're just going to like when the other option is Chinese virus, it was their fault. Right.
So I find Ben Shapiro an interesting character. I disagree with a lot of what he says. I think his delivery sometimes is a little bit sinister, and I think he likes to be angry about things. But I also admire some of the things he does and the way things he explains. And one of the things I like he does with Trump is he will say about the things he thinks he's done well, and he'll criticize it. Mm-hmm. One of the real problems I have with politics right now is the... I said it on Twitter the other day. Somebody was like, Trump derangement syndrome. But there is a Trump defensive syndrome, whereby anything he does, however egregious, can be defended. And I think the most interesting people who are able to politically observe and criticize and compliment and give credit where due to both sides, rather than just say always, oh, that's just the liberal left-wing way, or just say, or just that unilateral hatred for Trump. Neither work for me. And the reason they don't work, because it's just completely and intellectually dishonest. There is no world which suits... There is no world where everything is correct right or everything's correct left, because it doesn't account for different personality types and different economic positions. And I think the most intellectually honest thing you can ever do is be fair and be critical. And I've defended Trump sometimes, and which, by the way, in the UK is a really hard thing to do. Trump, it's really hard. You're not talking about 50% of the nation. You're talking about 5% of the nation who will agree with you. Everyone thinks honestly, everyone thinks he's a moron. I tried it with my brother and my dad over Christmas, and my brother refused to talk to me. And I said to him, well, the thing about Trump is I don't love him, but I'd rather him as the leader of the US than Hillary if I had to choose. Just because I think Hillary is crooked and evil, whereas I think Trump is just at times stupid. But I said the other day, when he called it the China virus, I said the rebranding, I think it's a disgrace. And the reason I think it's a disgrace is for a couple of reasons. I think firstly, I think all his press conferences are run as PR exercises.
Mm-hmm.
For him
well,
to
that's,
be calling,
that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, partway through one of them, somebody said something about Joe Biden. He said, yeah, sleepy Joe this. I just think it's so immature, pathetic, at a time when he's addressing the nation and the biggest crisis the US may ever face, the world may ever have faced. At a time where he needs to be addressing the nation, he's putting his little childish digs in about Joe Biden. And I think that was pathetic. I think calling it the China virus was totally a deflection exercise. And the really important thing for me, and I would have been equally critical if this had been a UK leader, is that during the biggest crisis a country has ever faced, or one of the top crises a country has ever faced, that you are still entirely focused on your personal reputation. That right now, all you're clearly thinking about is, will I win the 2020 election? Firstly, if it goes ahead. Let's just assume it's going to go ahead. And by the way, 3 months ago, it was a slam dunk. I think even a month ago, it was a slam dunk. He was winning the next election.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think even Biden or Bernie Sanders would have the ability to remove him. I think this coronavirus and what happens puts under threat. I think it makes it more debatable about whether he'll win the next election, because he's going to be judged entirely on this. And it might be out of his hands. Yeah, he might have done the best things possible. He might have put in the best policies possible straight away. Either way, a lot of people are going to die, and there's going to be an economic crisis. And because of that, people might hold him accountable, even though he couldn't have done anything anyone else had done. But for him at this time to be using the most important time in the country as a continual and very obvious PR exercise, I think that's disgraceful, because I understand a small amount of it's going to happen. But for each time for him to come out and say, we've done the perfect job. We've got these people. They're amazing. They're tremendous. They're doing a perfect job. I think it's great to talk people up. But every time he refers back to himself, he said, well, I did the best job possible here. He's got universal belief that everything he does is perfect and right without any self-awareness. And I just think it's a dangerous time to be starting a war of words with the Chinese. And just in response, because if people listen to this, they might give some of the response I got on Twitter. Firstly, they said, no, you're just a typical liberal left focus on racism. Okay, firstly, I'm not lefty. Secondly, I never even want to mention racism. This to me was never about racism. This to me was about leadership, and I just thought it demonstrated weak leadership. Also, people were saying, well, such and such at the CCP had blamed the US. I said, fine. Then turn around and say, there's been accusations in the press from X, who said this is a US engineered virus. This is obviously ridiculous. We won't entertain such knowledge, and we will be speaking to their ambassador. I think there's more mature and better ways to deal with it than just to start going, the China virus. Like he runs this, every single policy and every decision is like, how can he meme it? And I don't know, dude. I just personally, it's actually, where has he grown in my estimation as somebody where I thought he was an idiot when he first came in. And after 4 years, I thought, do you know what? He's not as bad as I thought. He's done some good things there, and I can understand why people like him. Right now, he's lost some credibility with me. Which I know some people go, well, you don't fucking matter. Who cares? You're Brit and you're a nobody. But at the same time, I can imagine others will be feeling this as well.
No, I think that the hard thing in American politics right now, which spills into politics everywhere, is that it is internecine warfare. There are religious cults on both sides. And if you are someone who feels like can likes people from both sides, has different opinions from both sides, it's not even center. Unfortunately, center is not a really good term. It's more like a bouncer, right? Like you're like a ping pong ball, because there's got like people are big and diverse, and their experiences make them feel different things, you know? And it is, I think that's the challenge for people, is that when everything becomes politicized, but how can it not be, you know? Let me ask you a question, actually, because I want to touch on this a little bit. You just had a big trip where you went to places that were having a hard time of it even before the coronavirus. How have the last couple weeks, well, one, like, you know, what was that trip about, and what were some of your takeaways? But how has the last couple of weeks of seeing the world respond to coronavirus recontextualized it for you? Like, that's the type of thing where I have trips that I took that I thought meant one thing, but in retrospect, the thing that I learned was very different, you know?
Yeah, good question. So the transitions from having a Bitcoin podcast, having two podcasts, was very much about wanting to expand outside of just being able to talk to people about Bitcoin. I did it a few times on the Bitcoin podcast, but there were subjects I wanted to touch on. And so I launched the other one, Defiance. And really, that was just for me to learn, you know, as an education process for me, but also, yeah, just to expand outside of the Bitcoin. And what I found very quickly in doing Defiance and traveling, because I used to travel to cities where I could cover Bitcoin and Defiance. And what I realized traveling was that actually the Defiance stuff is sometimes more visual. It's things you need to see. You know, you need to visually see what is, you know, Hong Kong. I can do an interview with somebody about Hong Kong, but really what's going to be much more effective and much more powerful is a video of people protesting and maybe short, snappier interviews with people there. So I realized that actually Defiance needs to be at least a film brand alongside it, potentially only a film brand. Perhaps it isn't a podcast in the future, that I don't know. So I also just wanted to become a filmmaker myself, just ambition-wise. You know, I really enjoy doing the podcast. I've really enjoyed doing the specials like the one on Mount Gox. And in doing Mount Gox, I realized, so I'm going off on a tangent, but bear with me, it all comes back together. Doing the Mount Gox, I realized.
Well, you know what we're doing right now? We're basically doing the thing that, like, you know, all of our elected leaders are now advising us to, which is like the way that you deal with social distancing is you just like call up your friends, do a video chat and talk about things that you wouldn't have normally talked about. So for anyone who's listening, like treat it as such. When I do my intro for the show, I'll make sure to make that point that it's not like we're going to go over the recent price action and what it all means. It's definitely not that. But so go off on any tangent is my point.
But yeah, so when I did the Mount Gox series, straight away afterwards, I wanted to do it again because it was just a sequential set of interviews. It was 6 interviews. Actually, what I really wanted to do was research the story, create a narrative and an arc, do the interviews, knit them together, and run it like a documentary. And I've been working on one about Bitcoin as well, which you know, I'm deep into. And the natural progression is I can produce audio documentaries. That's fine. But I'd like to produce video documentaries, just a personal ambition. So I bought all the equipment, all the camera equipment, and I decided I was going to head back to South America because I really wanted to go to Venezuela because I could do 2 things. I could cover Bitcoin because it's always seen as a Bitcoin use case, and I could cover the economic crisis. But as I was going there, I was like, well, I'll go to Colombia, I'll go to Bolivia, and I'll go to Chile. I'll do them all together. So I went out there with this intention of just starting filming and making some film work. And then I'd been talking to this producer / camera operator for a while. And he said, look, I'll come out with you. So I was like, fine, I'll pay for you. And it was really just meant to be a test. Go out to these 4 countries, film a bunch of stuff, see what we've got at the end of it. We struck gold a few times. We got very lucky with what we stumbled across and the content we were able to make. But what resonated for me, it was like 2 things came together at the same point. Somebody had said to me, you're going to really have to figure out what it is you're making, Pete, and why you're making it. What's your angle? You know, what is it about you that people should watch your videos and what you care about? And that was really stuck with me. I was like, yeah, you're right. I can't just film shit and put it out there. You know, what is it I do care about? And I know, in my heart, I know it's human stories. Like, whenever this shit's going off, I just care about the human stories at the back of it. And to give a good example of that is just having been out to Turkey and Greece with the border. I think in that situation, everyone's got a valid argument. The Turkish government got a valid argument that they've got 3.7 million migrants in the country. That's a lot of pressure. How many can they take? And I think the Greek government are right when they turn around and say, look, we've already taken 1 million in. We can't take any more. And I think the people who live in Germany or Sweden who've experienced mass social unrest from the integration of migrants have got a valid argument saying this hasn't worked out well for us. Yet, it doesn't matter who is right. In the middle of all this, there are a bunch of people who are fearful or don't want to live in their homes. Let's move away from the economic migrants. Let's just deal with the people who want to leave Iraq because the country is a basket case since the US war. Or let's talk about the people who've left Somalia, which is a very dangerous country. Or let's talk about the people who've left maybe Burundi, or just all these different countries. Whoever's right about their economic argument, there is a group of people here that were all stuck on the border between Greece and Turkey, living in a field where women have no access to sanitary products. They've got babies they're feeding. They're all living on 1 or 2 meals handed out a day. They're trying to leave a country that doesn't want them, trying to get into another country that is firing tear gas at them. But these are just people, right? And that's the point I'm trying to get to. I wanted to make films about people, just the real struggles that some people will go through. But what I found is it doesn't matter where I go, Nathaniel, the pattern is the same and the stories are the same in that there's this ongoing battle of left v. right, rich v. poor. And this is where I end up questioning some of the libertarian stuff, or, you know, when people say Bitcoin fixes this, because I don't believe in every single scenario Bitcoin does fix everything. There is certainly a situation right now where if there is too much inequality and too much corruption, you will see the poorer poorer people tend to rise up, who tend to be a little bit more left-wing because they tend to look at the world and say, it's a bit unfair. It's a bit unfair because we're poor, we don't have healthcare, and we don't have education. So we think that should be provided because that's how they feel. And we've somehow got to try and find a way of getting this balance right, because if we continue to have unequal societies, it doesn't matter what you politically think is right here. It doesn't matter if you think these people are socialists and socialism is bad. You are still going to have violent uprisings and people are still going to die. And I'm seeing this pattern, the same argument. It doesn't matter if I'm in Santiago, Chile, in Venezuela, or in San Francisco. You have got the same problem of inequality leading to problems, and you've got people feeling left out by society, or feeling that it's just a bit unfair because all the leaders are corrupt, and you know, what are they meant to have? And that pattern I'm seeing everywhere, like everywhere I go, and it's just a different story told in a different way. In Venezuela, it is because Maduro is essentially a ruthless dictator who took over from Chavez, who himself slipped into authoritarianism after his social program started to fail. But you've still got a rich v poor corruption problem there. It's the same in Chile. And I think we have very similar situations in Europe and the US. And I don't know. It's just, it's what I'm seeing everywhere.
I think
Sorry, I've gone on there a bit. I can't fully articulate it always because I'm still trying to figure it out in my head. But you also ask, how does what's happening now recontextualize that? I'm not sure it does, but what I'm expecting is those situations or those countries with the highest inequality and the poorest countries are going to suffer even worse through this situation, because what's going to happen is their healthcare systems are going to be overrun quicker. They're going to have higher numbers of people who can't get access to the healthcare system. They're going to have people whose health is maybe slightly worse because those who are poorer tend to have poorer health generally. And I know it's a massive generalization. And ultimately, I think in all of these situations, the more wealthy you are, the easier coronavirus is going to be for you to survive, because you're going to be able to get food, you're going to be able to get access to health. And I just think it's going to disproportionately affect poorer people. So if anything, that's what I'm observing.
So in 2010, Haiti had it was a magnitude 7.0 earthquake that was hugely devastating, right? And the reason that an earthquake like that is so much more devastating for Haiti than it would be in, say, San Francisco now, right, who's due for one, is that what kills in an earthquake isn't the earth shaking. It's buildings falling down and fire starting, right? And in a place where there is immense infrastructure, even if you're dealing with the same magnitude of earthquake, two wildly different outcomes. And I tend to agree that my fear with one of my fears geopolitically with the coronavirus is that, like, I just saw that there was a big increase in South Africa overnight. And, you know, South Africa is more, has more infrastructure than most parts of the continent, but it's still, it's not most of Europe, right? It's certainly not Lombardy, Italy, which has one of the best health systems, you know, in the world. It is a very different thing. And I think that if the equivalent of buildings falling down in this case is the health system coming under more pressure than it can, and the ripple effects, not just from people who die from coronavirus, but other people who can't get treatment for other things, you know, the death rate doesn't stop because of coronavirus, you know, the birth rate doesn't stop because of coronavirus. I think it does have the potential to disproportionately impact people. And I think that what you're feeling and seeing around the world, certainly I've observed this as well, like one of the the reason that I thought that I was going to go spend my life doing conflict or post-conflict reconstruction was the jarring disconnect between the feeling that everything was fine in the 90s and the Cold War was over and it was great, and the fact that it was the bloodiest decade since the 40s when it comes to violent conflict, right? in terms of numbers of people who were actually killed. And how could those two narratives didn't like exist, right? But most of the world post-Soviet war has been in this very, we are in a very weird liminal in-between scenario and have been for a while. And the challenge is that, and going back to your left versus right point, the problem in situations of desperation and inequality is power. And power seizes whatever narrative works based on that. You know, what does left authoritarianism and socialist fascism, how does that look practically different than right authoritarianism and fascism? The answer is that it doesn't really. It's just what's the narrative that's useful on the way. And I think, again, having that sort of nuance and the ability to speak in those terms rather than just throw around. I mean, the problem is that we've lionized political words, right? We've made them capitals instead of lowercases, and they come with a preset of expectations that limit our ability to understand, right? It's easier to write off an entire country for being socialist than understanding the context in which people lived that made ceding authority to people over their lives. Like, most people want to live their lives uninterrupted. This was my experience. And my formative years were spent basically between the Middle East and in East Africa. And the number one thing over and over again is that if you get into people that have lived with conflict for a long time, they don't speak in these same generic political terms. They speak in terms of, you know, what allows them to live and move on with their lives, right? And that can be a dangerous situation. That's why Mubarak was in power in Egypt for 25 years, is that he was unbelievably good at, more or less people were fine, they just didn't have autonomy over this one part of their life, right? I was in Egypt when George Bush was elected, and you know, I was in a program basically because I was studying there. We had two types of kids, like the Lefty Save the World kids and the going into the CIA, got to study my enemy while I learn Arabic kids. And all of us were friends because we're human beings, and human beings can be friends with people who disagree, even though the media tells us differently now. And on the way home, we had gotten a hotel suite to watch the election results. People couldn't believe that this guy was going to get elected again. And he did, obviously. And it was really, really late. We saw those results at like 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. We were taking a cab home, and the taxi driver was going out of his way to tell us that he understood that we didn't have any control over this and not to feel bad. Meanwhile, we actually did, right? But the experience of having any actual hand in electing your leader was so foreign to them. And now this is 7 years before Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring. So it's different. It changed a little bit, although, you know, the legacy of that is still playing out. But the point of this is to say that everywhere I've ever been, what people care most about is, do I get to live my life? Am I scared for my kids? Like, full stop, and everything else. And that's why the danger in that comes when people can come with promises and say, cede this authority, cede this control to me, and I will give you more of that, you know?
Yeah, I think I don't want to say the one good thing that could come out of this. What I hope is when we come out of this, I think we've got two choices, right? As people, nations, politicians, we've got a chance to reassess how we got here and the mistakes we've made and try and learn from this and have a better world, or it just gets worse. My fear is it will actually get worse. But can we learn from this? Because I'm disenfranchised from the political process because it's so divisive. It's like, you either agree with me or you agree with everything that they agree with, and you're bad. I didn't vote in the election because I couldn't vote for either Boris or Corbyn because they were just so poles apart. But there were so many things in the world I'm also questioning. And I think as a parent, you question it more, especially as your kids can ask questions. Yeah, and you can influence them. Like, my son says things now that he only says because he's my son. Like, when the government recently, a few days ago, announced their massive spending plans, he was like, but Dad, if they keep printing money like that, the money's going to be worth less, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, you buy more Bitcoin. Like, that's all come from him hearing me talk about it. But it also makes me realize that if I talk to him about politics, I can really influence them. If I just sit there and say, you know, you need to be conservative, and the conservatives are better because they focus more on hard work, whereas the Labour are more socialists and they want to help everyone and make everyone's lives easy, he's going to come out thinking potentially that poor people are lazy. We should stop helping them. And that worries me as well. And I don't know, I'm not really articulate. This is the kind of thing I wish I'd had some time to articulate and think about exactly what I wanted to say. But all I know is that if I used to have a certain way of viewing the world when I used to sit on my couch, sit at home and live in Bedford and follow the news and talk to my friends. And I would pick a side, like a football team that I'd want to be on. And now as I've traveled the world and I've been so fortunate to do this and met so many amazing people and people in difficult situations. I don't want to be on a side, because I realize most of the time the side you're on, is a lot of it's got to do with where you were born. You know, the fortune of being born in a country like the UK versus being born in Iraq, I don't know, pre-Gulf War II. I mean, that's what a fortunate position to be in. And a lot of what we have is just down to just pure luck and chance. And I think we're in a world now where we've got too much about I want and me and focus on me, and not enough about the empathy for others, and enough regard for human life, enough regard for really shitty situations people have to live through. God, I'm probably sounding like a really soft left-wing liberal.
But isn't that a problem when wanting to encourage like empathy and understanding the lived experience of people is relegated to one side or another? By the way, that used to be a small C conservative position. If you look back, right? Like historically before the, you know, whatever, that was a traditionally conservative position, you know? So this is the problem, is that these things, there is inherently a dynamic between leaders and the people who need to back them, where it's a process of narrative making and freeing yourself from that. And I think there's a liberation to existing in a way where you're not afraid to not know things and you're not afraid to change your opinion. And unfortunately, nothing in society really rewards you for that. But I'm interested, at least, and part of the reason that I spend so much time creating these media spaces is like I feel like I had a choice when it comes to the crypto space or political space or whatever. Like, it is very clear the path to engagement is picking a tribe always and just being the best at shouting that tribe's message. And this is, by the way, this is not a Bitcoin or Ethereum thing, although that it plays out a little bit like that. But honestly, crypto is, I think, light years ahead of most industries when it comes to this stuff. It just feels intense because we're in it. But like, if you think like left versus right identity politics and shit makes Bitcoiners versus Ethereum kids look like absolutely nothing. And, you know, for me though, like I am firmly committed to this, to creating spaces where you get to say like, this is my incredibly strong, intense opinion based on what I know now. But if you got something else, whether it's new facts or a new way of looking at things, like bring it on. And I'm not scared of that conversation, because you disagreeing doesn't fuck with who I am. It doesn't hurt my soul. It is an interesting thing where maybe I'll learn from that, you know, or maybe I'll think you're terrible and, you know.
You're just talking about the Roger Ailes playbook, right? Fox News, Roger Ailes, when he came in and he formed Fox News. Yeah, his strategy, he said, let's just be conservative. Uh-huh. Let's be conservative, let's focus on Republican issues, and then we get 60% of the population. Yeah, because if we do what CNN is doing and MSNBC is doing, then we're fighting for the same audience. We can have all of this audience. And therefore, Fox News, for me, it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment of a TV channel, because it is never impartial in any way at all about any decision of Trump or the Republicans. It can never step back and go, do you know what? This is wrong. We shouldn't be speaking like this, or these kinds of policies are wrong. It's every single thing he does, they support. And that, for me, is a really sad reflection on the world, because what it does divide us all. And it puts us all in separate camps of hate. You know, it's not what are the reasons that Trump should be president ahead of Joe Biden? What can he do better? What can we learn from this? No, let's hate Joe, sleepy Joe. Let's humiliate him. Let's really fucking humiliate him and And let's create hate for liberals, and let's get the liberals. And by the way, they do it the other way. And let's get the liberals hate themselves. Let's all just fucking hate each other and go to war, and then want to win our election. And then for 4 years, we're just going to laugh at you and create memes about you. Honestly, it's not how I want to live in the world anymore. And in some ways, this is why I'm rejecting politics and stepping away from it. Or I'm setting a new standard of what I expect from politicians. And you're right. You know, we're in the content space. I could very easily be a Bitcoiner who's like, I'm Bitcoin and I'm Bitcoin only. Fuck the state. I'm all about freedom, civil liberties. But I can't do that because, you know, firstly, not everyone. I don't believe anarcho-capitalism. I'm not convinced that creates a better world, a nicer world, or a safer world. It potentially creates a crazier world where it's all for himself and everyone has to own a gun. And I don't want guns in the UK. I just don't. I appreciate why you have them in the US and I've come to learn about it, but I don't want that situation. So I don't know. I tend to get in a lot of fights or shout out on Twitter because I don't follow the Bitcoin narrative all the time. I don't. I just don't always agree with everything. This kind of narrative where you have to be this anarcho-capitalist. I think it's immature, actually, and I think it's impractical. I think it's much more mature to just try and say, look, we do live in a world with a state. How do we make it better? Like what Eric Voorhees said to me when I said about, I can't see this world of libertarianism. He said, we don't need to. The starting point is less government. Let's just try and have 5% less government and see where we get. And then another 5%. And does that make the world? And that, I think that's a much more mature and practical place to go. But just to sit there and, you know, we're going to have the armies on the streets in the UK probably within a week. I don't want to just go, it's just bad because it's authoritarianism. But I want to just have a fair debate and say, hold on, is this a good thing? Could this actually save lives? And can we retract from it? And will this be a good short-term measure? And that's something I'm really struggling with right now because if anything, people are going to go, oh, you're a snowflake or you've got no bollocks. You're not really willing to take a side. You're just sitting on the fence. And I don't think it's that I'm sitting on the fence. I think I'm genuinely concerned about how we've got to where we've got to and how we debate these issues. Yeah.
Funny time. I also... It's weird times. I mean, unfortunately, the question I ask every person I've had on for the last couple of weeks has been, you know, where are you kind of in a optimism or pessimism cycle? And for me, you know, my answer is, the short-term optimism is that like, at least literally we're at the end of the first week where everyone was acknowledging this is a real thing, right? It's literally been only, we have one full week on our docket of actually acknowledging it. That's short-term optimistic. Short-term pessimistic is that I think that we're accepting, we're in the acceptance phase that there's going to be some disruption. We haven't yet accepted for how long it's going to be disrupted. And we haven't probably really dealt with the economic ramifications for just regular people, not just stock markets. And I also think that we haven't even begun to experience or understand the long-term geopolitical issues that come out of this. If there is a cause for some amount of long-term optimism, it's that when the world gets turned upside down, you can either reconstruct it exactly as it was, or you can try to find new narratives, new stories, new tribes, new ways to organize tribes that don't match the old way of thinking. And you know, it's not a nothing signal. I joked on Twitter this morning. I said, one of my top five thoughts during this crisis is, wait, I agree with who? And it was actually in the context of Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson going hard on Burr and Kelly Loeffler and a couple others about the potential that they use privileged information about to get out of the stock market, you know, when they were publicly talking. She's been fighting for her whole life. This is a very complicated, so here's the nuance side. Immensely complicated question because you have to figure out, like, does she actually have any control over her money? And there's a much larger question about how politics should deal with having assets that are outside the market because politicians are going to have advanced information on almost every scenario. Yeah. Secondly, like, look back at all of our conversations on Bitcoin Twitter since the end of January. It wasn't like this was only politicians who knew how bad this thing could be. We all made decisions in our our personal finances. So those are the sides that are kind of like it's overblown and people are looking for someone to blame. And I do think people are looking for someone to be angry on. The flip side and why people are angry, and I believe legitimately angry, is that when you spend 6 weeks telling people publicly that it's just the flu and that it's nothing and that we're doing a great job and it's all contained and it's not a thing to worry about and keep going to work. And then meanwhile, you are making an entirely different set of decisions for your life, if that's actually the case. That's just, it's not just hypocrisy, it's lying. And in the, and underlying all of this is the endangerment of the public, right? Which is, I think, is the, for me, the biggest issue. Like, I don't care that $3 million was moved, although I think it is a little fucked and hypocritical. What I care about is that you spent 6 weeks endangering the lives of people, because I just heard from a friend that they lost their 99-year-old grandmother because she couldn't get in. And maybe that would have happened no matter what, but if we'd started building, you know, field hospitals and gotten ventilators and all the sort of things that we needed 6 weeks ago, like maybe it wouldn't. And so I think, but anyways, like I said, two people who I basically disagree with on almost everything, Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson, were both very like hardcore about this, you know? Now, I don't pay attention to them enough to know if they have other beef with these people, and this is just a convenient media thing either. So it's not so much that I'm like, go those guys now, you know? Although you had some interesting things to say about Ben Shapiro, at least. It's more just that I think that living in a world where you're not going to cut off something that someone says because you think in advance that you don't agree with them is a weirdly healthy place to be, I think, if one that is also can feel destabilizing sometimes because you're out of the path. So I don't know how to, as we reconstruct and re-architect a new world, which I do believe that this is like a fucking forest fire for us. But I hope that we can, my fear is that it just does the same thing that happens in power vacuums, which is authoritarianism. My hope is that we have a chance to kind of organize it differently.
Yeah. I think that's a really good place to end it, to be honest, because I don't want to add to that. I think you've just given a summary that you've kind of re-articulated my point, that is, and I'm just going to repeat what you said earlier, is I think it's only natural that we're going to see an overreach of the government right now. And we're going to see this globally. And back to what you said, is how do they retract from that position? Because it might be hard for them through the temptations of power and corruption. But rather than try and fight what they're doing now, because we can't, how do we make it vocal? How do we ensure, as we come out the back end of this, that we don't lose our civil liberties? Because if they're using our phones to track us right now because on the track the movement of the virus, fine. It's not that I like it, but if it happens, it happens. How do we ensure when we come out the back of this that they don't continue doing that? And that's, you've actually shifted my thinking here, in that's almost where I think my personal focus would be, is acceptance of what's going to happen, because I can't change it. But what we can do is influence how we come out of this.
That's kind of where I am. Yeah. I don't know if we can, but I it's a, you know, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. So
yeah,
you know.
Well, dude, listen, it's always a pleasure. We should do this more often. I don't know why we don't. We should talk more often. I always enjoy our conversations. You make me rethink things. You make me reconsider my firmly held position sometimes. Look, it's a strange world. All I'm going to say to you is I'll say to everyone, stay safe, bro. It's concerning times. Stay safe in terms of personal health, but also mental health. I think somebody, I won't name them because they might not have want me to say it, but somebody also shifted my thinking yesterday. They said, why hasn't anyone talked about the mental health impacts of this at a level where we need to come to an acceptance? We are going to see a higher level of suicide through this process. It's only natural that will happen. We have suicide rates. The suicide rate is almost certainly going to go up through this as people face very, very tough situations. So that's something we need to be aware of. But just as a friend, just stay safe, stay healthy, and stay mentally healthy, and everyone listening. If anyone is struggling, my DMs are always open. My phone's always available if someone wants to talk. And if I can help in any way, please let me know. But yeah, stay safe, bro.
You too, man. Thanks for
Hold on. What am I doing? I'm concluding your interview like this is mine. I felt like this is the end of mine.
No, I like it. You interview me. That's what happens. You could put two podcasters in a room. What happens, right?